I'll now introduce the members of our commentary panel, who I'm sure are known to many of you. We will have a panel discussion that will run till about 10 minutes to 2, and then we'll throw open to the floor for questions for around about 20 minutes. So we're aiming to finish promptly at 2:15, as I mentioned before. To introduce you to our panel members, we have Belinda Robinson, who has been the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association since July 2005. Prior to that, she was the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Plantations, Products and Paper Industry Council and worked for the Commonwealth Government. Climate change and environmental policy feature very heavily in the roles that Belinda has undertaken. We also have Des King, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Caltex Australia, a position to which he was appointed after having worked with Chevron Corporation. He's worked in the oil and gas exploration and production industry for over 25 years and is a board member of the Australian Institute of Petroleum. Greg Bourne is the Chief Executive of World Wildlife Fund Australia. After a long stint working with BP across three continents from 1971 to 2003, Greg took up his current position in October 2004. In addition, Greg's a member of the CSIRO Sector Advisory Council to the Natural Resource Management and Environment Sector and a member of both the National Environmental Education Council and the Advisory Council for the CSIRO Energy Transformed Flagship. Greg is also a recipient of the Centennial Medal for Services to the Environment. Mitch Hook is the Chief Executive of the Minerals Council of Australia and has held that position since April 2002. The Council represents companies that collectively produce around 90% of Australia's mineral output. In that role, he recently chaired the first APEC Industry Forum in Perth, and he's held a number of industry leadership positions and has been a significant contributor to the development of Australia's trade, economic and industry policy through his participation on various government councils and panels. Our last panel member is Carlo Botto. Carlo is the Director of Portfolio Management at True Energy, where he has responsibility for managing True's wholesale gas and electricity assets, as well as managing government and regulatory affairs. Carlo has worked extensively in New South Wales, Victorian and Queensland in electricity industries, as well as in the United States. And Carlo is taking the place of Richard McIndoe, who's unable to attend due to a last-minute engagement in Melbourne. I intend to open the panel session with some questions from me as the chair, and because of time constraints, we'll keep the responses relatively short, but hopefully there'll be some interaction. After that, as I've said, we'll take questions from the floor. I guess the first question I'd like to address to Mitch. Mitch, there are a number of industries who are lining up for some sort of assistance under the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. Those of you who have read the Financial Review this morning will see that the gold industry is the latest in that line. You, of course, represent a number of companies that dig out raw materials and export them, and they will be amongst the most heavily hit, both in terms of their direct emissions and their indirect emissions attributable to electricity. Do you think that the scheme proposed by the Green Paper strikes the right balance between, on the one hand, trying to make a significant dent in our emissions, yet on the other hand, in protecting Australia's economy?
Well, thanks, Jim. I certainly agree with Martin that the design of the system has to be economically efficient and socially acceptable, as well as being environmentally effective. But I'd actually like to turn around the other way. It's not about carving out my sector or anybody else's sector for special assistance. It's actually about Australia is an emissions-intensive economy. Notwithstanding that we have reduced our emissions intensity since 1990 by something like 44% and expected to get another 60% reduction in emissions intensity by 2020, the bottom line is that I wouldn't and don't really want to be playing in this space. I don't want another food fight GST kind of debate. where the arguments about some arbitrary barriers and some arbitrary determinations about who's in and who's out. And this actually ought to be about how this economy can go through a measured transition to a low emissions, low carbon economy. I agree with Martin. I don't know anybody who seriously contests the concept of global warming. And even if they do, then look at the precautionary principle, which says you don't need the science to smack you in the face before you do something about it. And I agree, it's a hedge and it's an insurance. But there are some very fundamental principles that we ought to be adhering to. And those, the first one is alignment. And that is alignment of a global protocol, negotiations, alignment of the technology developments, and alignment with market-based mechanisms. And if you get any one of those three out of sync, you've got an argument for compensation. And you get this incongruous kind of setup we have at the moment, where this debate is being severely distracted by the politics of compensation, where we're actually trying to compensate people for the very things we're actually trying to stimulate a change in behaviour for, which is kind of not really getting to the fundamental issue. So our view is that you want alignment between your three pillars of change in managing climate change. You certainly want to have comparable adjustment across the globe, and that's part of the global protocol, global solution. I mean, the notion that the EU will be able to do sort of 20% cuts by 2020, well, they only have to do 14% better than what they're doing to get to that. We would have to do 33% better than what we're doing. Our GDP growth has been twice that of the Europeans, five times their growth in population, and those GDP and population are the two things that really contribute to your greenhouse gas emissions. So you really need to put all this into sort of context. We've had to work twice as hard than the Europeans to get a reduction to our Kyoto targets of 108, and we'll have to go 2.5 times as hard to get to a 20% reduction on a business as usual platform than the Europeans. And in terms of comparable adjustment and measured transition, the European system for emissions trading, it's been said here today, well, let's not lead, we shouldn't lag either. If we want to be in sync with the Europeans, they won't move to full auctioning of permits until 2020. They're only covering 40% of their emissions. We're going to look for 70%. They will start in the 9th year of their scheme where we would like to start, and that is a phased to full auctioning. So rather than carve-outs for the emissions sectors, the trade-exposed emissions, the trade-exposed emissions intensive, to your acronym, I'd much prefer to start off with a 20% allocation of permits right up front, 20% that you have to buy, put a nominal price of, say, $20 of carbon on it, throw 80% into the ring. People say, well, that was the reason why there were windfall profits in the EU system. Wrong. The latest analysis of the EU system says it was the amount of over-allocation and that they didn't allow bankable permits, so they didn't actually retain their inherent property rights. So you could actually set it up so that you've got a measured transition that allows you to bring your technologies in a line, your market mechanisms, so they're actually a market price, not a tax and a blunt indiscriminate instrument that's punitive rather than incentivized. And if you put all that together, then you can, in fact, move in sync with the rest of the world. We do establish the framework. It does what Martin says, and that is set you up so that you can have a robust and flexible operation going forward. So my take-home message out of this is, yeah, there are schemes out there that we can be in sync with. There is an opportunity for us to design a system here that is a measured transition, that is comprehensive, that doesn't get us into a food fight where we're trying to carve out bits and pieces. You set it up so that there's auctioning in the first year of, say, 20%, there's free allocation, and then you just keep ramping it up as you go through the process. But the idea is measured, alignment, comprehensive, comparable adjustment.
All right. Thanks, Mitch. Carlo, I guess along similar lines, of course, you're in an industry that will be particularly affected by the carbon pollution reduction scheme in the electricity coal generation industry. And indeed, the Green Paper devotes its longest chapter to discussing that very issue, although I think it's fair to say that the sorts of conclusions that are drawn probably don't give a huge degree of substantial comfort to the industry. What are your views on the level of assistance that you think the industry needs And how confident are you that you'll get it? And in fact, if you don't get it, what are the consequences likely to be?
Thanks, Grant. First of all, yes, we are an industry that's deeply affected. First of all, probably on two fronts, a little bit of context. The scheme proposed is a very, very broad scheme. That said, electricity generation will probably represent about 50% of that scheme. So it's a very large portion of the scheme. And secondly, particularly on the coal-fired front, it's been recognised in the paper that we are, as a sector, particularly the coal-fired sector, disproportionately adversely affected. So they're probably the two main reasons why the focus on our particular sector and coal-fired generation, and keeping in mind that 85% of our energy is generated from coal-fired generation in this country, unlike Europe, for example. So that's just a little bit of context. In terms of the Green Paper itself, from the point of view of what it presents, it's presented, I think, a very pragmatic framework, which is pretty balanced. And as you say, it's created a platform, but there's a bunch of numbers that are missing. The way I kind of describe it, it's a good platform with plenty of levers in terms of what to do. Now we just want to see how hard those levers are pushed or not. In terms of the scheme itself, compensation or transitional support to the coal-fired sector represents an opportunity to gracefully transition into a low-carbon world, and I'll expand on that in a moment. But it's quite important, and I'll get on a little later, to distinguish between the assets that are involved, the power stations that are involved, and the companies that are actually involved. The Green Paper does acknowledge the reason for transitional support being paid to the sector is to ensure that we maintain investor confidence. There's many tens of billions of dollars invested in the current generation stock, and to transition that 85% coal-fired stock into a low or no emission generation stock over the relatively short period of time will require massive amounts of investment in the medium to long term. And so it's quite important to make sure that investor confidence to put those dollars into a market where the scheme itself is effectively an artificial scheme developed by government. It doesn't actually trade a real commodity. It's a commodity determined by government to deliver a policy outcome. So it's critically important that not only the scheme is a good one, but the confidence in the government managing that scheme is also there by investors. So first of all, in terms of the level of assistance, well, some of the key numbers are missing. So from that point of view, I'll say a few things. First of all, the generation sector is a very, very efficient industry. It's been operating extremely efficiently, and we're about to introduce a cost, bringing an external cost that hasn't been costed before into the equation, and that's the cost of carbon. And as a result of that, that will present an economic shock to the sector. So from that point of view, this sector, as I said previously, is disproportionately affected. And from that perspective, the balance sheet impact associated with that shock is a very significant one. Unfortunately, the market design really prevents us from basically passing those costs effectively on to the consumer. Electricity prices will go up, but the nature of the market means that there will be an enormous margin squeeze on generation. And that's where the transitional support is required. Unlike Europe, where allocation was done based on historical emissions, the two reviews that have been conducted by government have recognised the problems of the European scheme, and are talking about providing transitional support to basically top up that margin that can't be basically passed on to consumers.
Go across to Greg, actually. there have been some very good points made about the need for some industries to be given some sort of protection from the scheme, whether in the coal-fired industry or otherwise. Greg, what's your take on this? Because, of course, when one industry gets what some will call favourable treatment, others call justifiable transitional assistance, other sectors of the economy and consumers and so on bear a bit more of the burden. What do you think about that?
Okay, let me first start off by sort of going a little bit back to the context that Martin put in. There are big changes going on in the world's climate, and the way we put it is there's a polarity. If the world gets its act together in Copenhagen, all hell breaks out in the built economy. We change things really fast. We have a sustainability revolution, a really new industrial revolution. Conversely, if it doesn't get its act together, all hell breaks out in the natural environment, and you're seeing that in the Murray-Darling Basin right now and elsewhere. So these are really fundamental choices. So whatever we do with the ETS, we have to design to win. It has to be flexible, as Martin said, and it must be driving things forward and fast very, very effectively. So the green paper overall, I think, is really quite well balanced. It's a very broad green paper. It doesn't include agriculture, but agriculture is going to do it tough. Absolutely, it's going to do it tough, and it will eventually come into the scheme in a few years' time. Again, we're going up as Australia at plus 1% of emissions per annum, projected to do that until 2020. We have to be turning down at minus 2% per annum continuously for quite a long period of time. That is a real change. So to me, this is not about one sector or another sector. It's actually all sectors. And actually, stress is good. Necessity is the mother of invention. The softer we are on any one sector, the less inventive they will become. We need all sectors to be unbelievably inventive to beat this challenge.
Oh, well, thanks for that. And speaking of challenges, I guess, Des, yours is a bit of a different challenge from that faced by some of the other industries. Caltex is on record as saying that the carbon pollution reduction scheme will require you to spend, I think it's about $1.4 billion per annum on a carbon price of $40 per tonne of carbon dioxide equivalent to cover the downstream combustion of the petrol that you produce. Is there anything in the green paper that gives you some comfort that you'll be able to manage that risk, or what other refinements could you suggest to deal with that sort of an issue?
Yeah, I think the green paper was a good start in terms of how the whole legislation may end up evolving to. But you're absolutely right. The key is we'll be buying of the order of $1.4 billion a year worth of permits, and how can that be done efficiently? And it's worth looking at what the breakdown of that is. Caltex will probably buy of the order of permits of 40 million tonnes of carbon dioxide. So Caltex will be the number one buyer of permits in Australia, approximately 10% of the whole market. So that's a huge amount for one player to buy. But if the system's designed efficiently, we can do that. But it's really broken into two components. The first component is our refineries. We operate two refineries in Australia. And the emissions from those two refineries are just over 2 million tonnes a year. And so we'll buy permits for those refineries. Those refineries should be in the scheme, but we've argued that the carbon costs on those refineries should elevate as the offshore refineries elevate, because a quarter of all the products that we consume in Australia, the petroleum products, are imported. And they're imported from countries that don't have a carbon cost. And so we look forward to working with government to make sure, although refining wasn't included in that category of companies that should get some carbon relief in the early years, that should be the case. Otherwise, people like Mobil have said they'll close and go offshore. All that's doing is then making us more dependent on imports. So now 25% of our fuel is imported. It could easily get to 50% very quickly, which is a security supply issue. So the measures for industries, whether they get some kind of carbon relief until the rest of the world catches up, is tied to revenue. We think it should be tied to some kind of value-add measure, because an industry like ours, we buy 240,000 barrels a day of oil as Caltex. That's very expensive. So we have high revenues because our raw material cost is high, then pass it through with a slight uplift. So but definitely encourage that there's relief for energy-intensive industries like ours that are exposed to offshore. And we look forward to working with government to make sure that so there's better measures in there to take account of that. So that's really the refining side. The other side, though, is our customers at biofuel, as you point out, consume, oh goodness, over 35 million tonnes a year of CO2 emissions, and that's growing.
And if you look at what the way the scheme is proposed, we need to make sure that for end fuel users, it's a very transparent system, and that we can stand in front of consumers and say, cent for cent, the carbon cost has been passed through to you. Because if you look at the four major fuel suppliers in Australia, that Caltex is number one, BP, Shell and Mobil, those four companies will be buying approximately 25% of all the carbon permits, depending who's in the scheme, for fuel users. And we all know the sensitivity of consumers to petrol prices, so we need to make sure the scheme is well designed with that purchasing concentration, those four companies, so consumers can feel assured that the carbon cost they pay in their fuel, permits bought for us by us and passed through, is delivered cent for cent. So I think this, the Green Paper is a good start, and I look forward to working with government to work out the details. So as we as Caltex, the number one buyer in Australia, have frequent permits, the cent for cent pass through to consumers who buy our fuel, and also our industry is in the scheme, but its carbon cost is elevated in line with those offshore refineries that do set the wholesale price in Australia.
Well, thanks for that, Des. We tend to read a bit about the risks, I guess, more than the opportunities that carbon trading brings, and maybe that's just a reflection of the newspapers, tending to dwell on the gloomier side of things. Belinda, gas presumably is likely to be one of those sectors that benefits from the carbon pollution reduction scheme. I've seen it said that there's about 8,000 megawatts of additional generation capacity required by 2020, and gas, apparently if gas can supply just 1,000 megawatts of that capacity, then that takes up 70 petajoules per annum, which seems to me quite a substantial number. Could you tell us a bit more about the upside that you think there is in the scheme, and indeed what could be done to make the scheme even better to encourage those opportunities?
Thanks, Grant. You're absolutely right in that the whole point, of course, of the carbon emissions trading scheme is to add a value to carbon. So, in other words, those energy sources that are less carbon intensive should play a much greater role, and we should see a much greater penetration of those fuels into not just the Australian but into the world energy mix. I'd be very interested to know whether people do understand. I'd like a show of hands. How many people think that by putting a price on carbon, that energy fuels with a lower carbon intensity should be the winners in this game? That's, I think, a very substantial number of people, a substantial group who I think understands the fundamentals of the scheme. I did notice, though, that there are a lot of people who kept their hands down, and that's either because they're shy, or I suspect, Martin, you should be having a queue outside your door trying to explain what the objectives of putting a price of carbon into the energy mix is all about. But that's absolutely true, but it's not quite that simple, and it's not quite that simple because Australia doesn't work in isolation from the rest of the world. We trade energy in the same way that we trade a whole bunch of other products. If we worked, if we did work in isolation and we had an emissions trading scheme here that wasn't influenced in any other way by the rest of the world, then gas could be expected to play a much greater role. And I believe gas will play a much greater role in Australia's energy mix precisely because it is less carbon intensive. But the other part of my business, and I represent the liquid natural gas producers as well, that's the trading part. You liquefy Australia's natural gas, you stick it in a fridge, you take it to a minus 161 degrees, just so you can stick it on a boat. So the only reason we produce liquid natural gas in Australia is to stick it on a boat and send it to Asia, primarily the Asia-Pacific region. And it's the Asian-Pacific region who fundamentally aren't subject to a cost of carbon or emission reduction obligations under the Kyoto Protocol, but who are still screaming out for energy just because their economies are growing so rapidly and their populations are growing so rapidly, and because they do actually want to do something and they do want to move to cleaner energy supplies. Australia is extremely well endowed with gas. We're finding much more than we're actually using or exporting. We do it well. We have incredible expertise in this country. We have the technology here. We're one of the founding countries who were involved in LNG. We're good at gas. We're really good at gas. One of the issues that we confront, though, through the preferred position that the government has outlined in its Green Paper, and I do want to say that the Green Paper, I think, has made a very significant effort to understand many of the complicated issues around this matter, But what we find in the Green Paper and the government's preferred position is that the LNG industry in the is totally exposed to a price of carbon because it is emissions intensive initially when you produce LNG. It does take a lot of energy and there are emissions associated with it. So it's totally exposed to the price of carbon, only and which is only a problem because the people that we're selling the LNG to are not. Our competitors are not. And so there are choices. If we can't make the price of gas stack up, or the project, or the economics of the LNG projects in Australia stack up, there are a number of responses to that. And Australia, bearing in mind that Australia is already one, is the most expensive place to develop LNG in supplying the Asia Pacific market. So that's the starting point. If we can't make those projects stack up, the Asian Pacific region is denied the ability to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to the tune of 120 million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent a year. Australia is denied $10 billion worth of tax revenue on an annual basis if we realise the potential that LNG has in this country. And so we would argue that everyone is worse off. So while the Green Paper acknowledges the issues around trade-exposed industries, what it doesn't acknowledge are those industries that have the most capacity to make a material difference, not only in assisting the Asian Pacific region address its energy security issues, not only in assisting the Asian Pacific region reduce its greenhouse gas profile, but to deliver on Australia's obligations under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to do everything it can to assist developing countries reduce its greenhouse gas emissions footprint. So I guess my closing statement is that that's one of the fundamental flaws. It doesn't take account of those industries that are actually able to make a significant global contribution to the effort. Secondly, one of its fundamental flaws, I think, is that it taxes exports, gives imports a free ride. We often hear that this whole game is not a game, it's actually incredibly serious, and I've been involved in it since 1980, but this whole issue is a significant economic reform. I would challenge anyone to identify any economic reform that had as its basis a tax on exports and imports get a free ride. Thirdly, it draws very heavily on a European model. A European model, Europe, of course, they don't have the exposure issues. They're not exposed to the same extent that countries that don't have an emissions reduction obligation. They are primarily trading within the European bubble. They also value gas, which is why they're turning themselves inside out to get their hands on Russian gas. And also, of course, they're not a resource-based economy. And thirdly, as I mentioned earlier, one of the fundamental problems with it is it doesn't acknowledge the capacity of Australia through its natural gas resources to make a very substantial and material difference to the world moving to a lower carbon-intensive economy.
Thank you very much, Belinda. Well, I'd now like to throw open to the floor for any questions you may have. I think you've had a diverse variety of views expressed from the panel. You've had the benefit of Martin Parkinson's presentation as well. If you'd like to ask a question, could I ask you that you raise your hand? A microphone will be brought to you. Could you then please state your name and the organisation you come from? And in the interest of getting through as many questions as we can I ask you to keep your questions fairly short or indeed any initial comments you might have fairly short as well. So do you have any takers?
Yes. Dermot Duncan from Suave Attorneys. Having come back from 7 years in the UK working solely in renewables and electricity, I'm interested to note about the price of carbon. I'll stand up, I'm over this way. The UK, talking about two different jurisdictions, UK looking at not only a market price for carbon, but also a social cost for carbon. Initial pricing estimates by DEFRA and also the widely renowned McKinsey report is probably pricing at around about $100 per tonne. I suppose it's to Dr. Parkinson, what sort of modelling are we doing on the price of carbon? And as probably suggested by one of the panel members, the option of implementing that through some sort of trajectory?
The government has a major exercise running in the Treasury at the moment that's looking at the costs of different trajectories and the intention is that that will be released in October, and then there'll be a discussion, period of public consultation around that before the government settles on its mid-term emissions trajectory target. So we have a 60% reduction objective by 2050, and then at the end of this year we will have settled not only what our mid-term target should be, but we'll also have settled what we think the emissions scheme cap should be for 2010-11 and 2011-2012. Just to give people some assurance, I don't think anybody is talking $120 a tonne for the CO2 equivalent.
Is there a question down in that section? Yep, thank you.
My name's John Daly. I'm an advisor to Woodside. Dr. Parkinson, in his address today, alluded to one of the key recommendations in the Shergold report about above the cap allocation, if you like, for trade exposed emissions intensive industry. And I think I heard him describe it as a get out of jail card. He also talked about the objectives of this green paper scheme being cast in stone. And I'm wondering whether those two things are the same, whether above the cap allocation is ruled out as a matter because policy is locked in stone. Thank you.
Good to see you, John. For those of you who don't know, John Daly worked with me and John Marley, who's down the front here, on the Prime Minister's Task Group on Emissions Trading. I won't say that John was one of the instigators of the above the cap approach, because that would be unfair. John, as you know, where